You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in? All right, enough of that. Joining me, the owner of that big reputation I was talking about earlier today, Jeff Zazulowitz, from all things covered by Navy Times. Jeff, first of all, good morning. How are you?
Good, man. How you doing?
I'm all right. No, man. Are you kidding? You're the man. I mean, everything I read has all those consonants in that last name.
Yeah, right.
Talk to me about the state of the Navy. It seems like there's this endless storyline of bad stories. You know, the LCS Billings running into a moored ship in Montreal Bay, the ongoing saga, you know, that kind of ended with both the commanding officer, the Fitzgerald, and the tactical action officer both not being able to be tried, the Gallagher trial, and now, you know, most recently, Admiral Moran, over the course of a weekend, says, yeah, I need to retire. So before we go into the specifics, is what's going on with the Navy? It's, the news tends to be horrible on a relatively consistent basis.
Yeah, you know, I haven't been covering the Navy for decades or anything, so I guess I can't put it into complete context, but, you know, going back to the Fat Leonard, scandal in the West Pacific and all these, you know, high-level officers taking all these bribes and prostitutes and booze from this contractor, you know, that's really, I think that's really decimated the 06 and above leadership of the service. And, you know, it does seem like, you know, a nonstop barrage of kind of these huge scandals. And, you know, I don't know what to make of it, but it's, you know, it's there, and it comes at a time when, you know, we need America's Navy to be stronger than ever as, you know,
right,
we try to counter, you know, this ascending China and this resurgent Russia and the ever-present, you know, menace from North Korea. So it's just a very difficult situation, and this whole Moran thing is just kind of like the latest, you know, thing to just run across the transom, I guess.
Wow, I like the little transom little thing you snuck in there.
Throw it in whenever.
Talk to me about this the Admiral Moran thing. I mean, he's already confirmed by the Senate, and
yeah,
you know, he's in. I mean, the guy who got held up was General Berger, you know, in a little event by a representative from Alaska. Looking for whatever he was looking for, which I would assume it would be more Marine participation in Alaska. But, and this thing, out of the blue, but it's, and again, there's obviously pieces missing, right? It goes back to a Christmas party gone wrong. Admiral Richardson takes 8 months to remove somebody from his staff that's the equivalent of a lieutenant colonel, which doesn't make any sense. And then he gets wire brushed in public, and that becomes an issue. And then his not removing him becomes an issue. And now this guy somehow has a professional or personal email relationship with Admiral Moran that somehow, now I have friends that, you know, that didn't leave the Marine Corps under great terms, but it's not like I can't communicate with them. So I guess what I don't understand.
You're also not a four star though, you know?
Oh, if I'm a four star, I can't talk to him?
Well, let me just, let's just back up real quick here. This for listeners who might not be totally familiar. I mean, this whole thing is, lawmakers dubbed it the bad Santa situation. And it goes back to this 05, Commander Chris Cervello in the Navy, who was like a main PAO for Richardson and Moran and very well liked among kind of the admiral ranks. He was just seen as a very effective PAO. He's at this Christmas party at the Pentagon and, is later accused of getting drunk and handsy with, some junior female officers. Never charged, not kicked out, got a letter of caution for it, I believe, and he was investigated. And like you said, Richardson didn't get rid of him and later had to eat crow with lawmakers. Yeah, and then it turns out that Moran's been communicating with him. You know, it's really bad. Santa's just like the gift that keeps on giving for Navy brass. You know, it's funny to think if this guy had just kept his hands to himself at that one Christmas party, none of this, we're not even discussing this right now. It's kind of this weird butterfly effect. But, yeah, you know, from what we're understanding in the reporting and what the Navy's put out, you know, Moran was kind of seeking Cervello's counsel on, you know, hearings and strategy meetings and all these things. And I think we really do need to see what was in those emails to determine kind of whether this whole thing, you know, was warranted. It's very difficult. I guess it's how you view Cervello's transgressions is a part of how you'll feel about this. But, you know, this comes at a time when we haven't had a permanent replacement for Mattis in the Pentagon since December.
Right.
You know, there's all these positions that need to be filled. Richardson, the current CNO, can only serve till mid-September, and Congress has, of course, their summer recess because they love their, you know, August recesses. They have a ton of people to confirm, and it's just like the clock is ticking, and, you know, with what happened with Fat Leonard, I mean, the bench is arguably thinner than, you know, maybe Secretary Richard Spencer would like it to be. Sorry, I'm just spinning. I hope all that makes sense. I'm just kind of...
No, we've been talking about it. So to me... To me, though, so the emails, I think it's safe to say were not, hey, the U.S. women's national team looks really good. Yeah, how was your Memorial Day weekend? What'd you do? They weren't of that nature. The reason for this kerfuffle is that they went beyond that to the point of, even though this guy was told to go away, Admiral Moran was including him in professional conversations.
Yeah, I mean, the Wall Street Journal reported today that, you know, a little bit deeper in that, you know, he was seeking, like, PAO guidance from this guy. And, you know, that also raises a question. You know, that would mean Cervello was, if that's in fact the case, what the emails are showing, you know, that means Cervello was essentially working for the Navy. You know, did his, consult company or whatever get, you know, a contract? We haven't seen any indication of that, but, you know, that will be another question that needs to be asked. But it all comes down to, I think, what's in the emails. And I imagine they'll come out at some point, and, you know, we'll see kind of what these communications really were.
Got it. So, and the path is via the Freedom of Information Act request for those emails.
I'm sorry?
The path that those emails come out is via Freedom of Information Act requests.
Lord willing, we'll see. You know, I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only reporter that's got them filed already. You know, the DODIG is conducting their own investigation, and sometimes the government will try to withhold emails like that and say, you know, oh, it's part of this investigation, we can't release it. But there's also some case law that you can't withhold things under FOIA that existed before an investigation kind of encompassed them, if that makes sense. So, you know, we'll see what happens, but, you know, I would imagine, you know, sooner rather than later, we'll see some of these emails and kind of get to make our own judgments in terms of kind of what they mean and whether this was warranted.
I've got an email for you. Mac, first of all, it's great to hear Jeff's voice on the program again. I enjoy his writings and enjoy when he's on the program as well. Had he heard any rumblings of this before the weekend?
Man, no. You know, and talking to other colleagues both in our newsroom and elsewhere who cover this, nobody was expecting this. I mean, he sailed through his Senate confirmation hearing.
Right.
You know, he's well-regarded. He was really considered a sailor as much as a four-star could be, and, you know, I never heard a bad word about him from anybody. I mean, he got kind of caught up in that UCI stuff with the CO from the Fitzgerald that you mentioned, but, you know, Richardson took most of the brunt on that. But, yeah, I don't think anybody was expecting this, you know. And it appears that, you know, USA Today, Tom Vandenberg, who covered a lot of this bad Santa stuff and broke it wide open, It appears part of this resignation came about because Vandenbroek started asking about these emails. So, whoever tips him off to it, God only knows. But none of this came up during his confirmation hearing. And he was expected on, August 1st to go out to the Naval Academy and take command of the Navy. So, yeah, nobody saw it coming. I mean, it's really been a shocker for both the fleet and the people that cover it, I think.
Got it. Could you translate for everybody UCI?
Oh, UCI, Unlawful Command Influence. So I'm not sure how much you've discussed this on the show, but the CO of the Fitzgerald, that collided. Oh, okay. So basically, Richardson was found to have been making public comments that were going to prevent this guy from getting a fair trial. And Moran was implicated in that to a lesser degree. But, during his Senate confirmation, it didn't come up as a big point. And I think everybody was like, okay, here's some smooth continuity as the Navy continues to take on more and more importance to the, national defense strategy and the future of America and the world. And, to say it was a shock, I think, is an understatement.
Another email here. Hey, Mac, I'm curious about his comments that the bench is getting thin. How thin is the bench for those of us who don't follow the Navy on a daily basis? Are there enough top-flight guys to still do this? Are we now going to B-team guys, guys who are not exceptional but are clearly above-average performers? Where are we? So, Jeff, what do you think?
Well, sure. Thanks for the question. The Fat Leonard thing, it forced a lot of captains and one-stars either into retirement or censured after retirement. But by law, the Navy is only allowed to have 6 4-star admirals on active duty at any one given time. Currently there are 8, but that's because 2 of them are leading the combatant commands of Southcom and Paycom.
Right.
That by the very nature of the numbers, there's a thin bench. And then, but Spencer, the SECNAV, could dive into the 3-star vice admiral pool if he wants to. I can run through kind of some of the names that are being, propagated as possible successors if you're interested in that.
Do you have a favorite who you think will be nominated? Do you have any inside baseball for us?
Well, I don't, I'm kind of loath to share personal opinions, but just in terms of career and reputation, Admiral John Aquilino took over as commander of Pacific Fleet, pretty recently, May of 2018. He's a career aviator and, has kind of been, scandal free. There's talk of Admiral Davidson, who leads Indo-PACOM, but he has had, he kind of oversaw a lot of surface, fleet stuff when the collisions happened, and he's had a few testy exchanges with, Senator Angus King about kind of surface fleet reform. So we'll see there. Admiral Fowler, who leads Southcom, has been touted, but he was kind of side-snagged in some Fat Leonard, stuff as well. There is Admiral James Fogo, who's the commander of NATO forces in Naples. But the thing about Fogo is that he's a clear submariner, and Richardson was a submariner, and they don't want to, I don't think they want to put the same type commander, type community in charge year upon year upon year, because I think, if you're an aviator, a submariner, or a SWO, you're going to bring kind of a different perspective to the job. So, but, it's all talk right now and it's all speculation, but, those are the names out there. And, for any of your readers or listeners listening in, rest assured we'll be on top of it and we're tracking it all. We'll let everybody know kind of the news as it develops and what it means beneath the surface as well.
2/3 of the earth is covered by water. The rest is covered by Jess Zulowitz, so that's where you'll get your information. another email question. I talked about this earlier. Mac, don't forget to ask him his thoughts on the Gallagher court-martial. I'm curious to see if Jeff shares that the wrong messages came out of that. So, obviously, pretty high-profile event, and many of us who served in Iraq and Afghanistan watching And the fact that somebody who's given immunity would change their testimony is not a strange occurrence for those that have followed court martials in the Marine Corps. But again, by his own statements, by his own text messages, whatnot, I mean, Gallagher clearly had a problem. The message, though, that got sent was, if you don't cover down on your buddies, if you don't stay inside the group, right, you will pay. I'm curious, at least that's my read anyway, which is, was not a good outcome for the Navy, in my opinion. You had, in my opinion, very courageous junior SEALs going to their leadership and saying, we've got a problem with this, on repeated occasion, and then, what won was, in my opinion, lie, stay within our brotherhood, which we are more loyal to than this greater code that we all raise our hand to. I'm curious about your thoughts of all of it. And I know you're a reporter and sometimes loathe to share opinions, but your thoughts.
Yeah, you probably won't get an opinion from me on it, but I think we can all agree it was a complete and total cluster. You know, this thing was, you know, just a mess from the get-go. And I think, you know, it starts from, you know, the investigators, NCIS, has, you know, they have no body. They have limited access to the people. I mean, this was, you know, right in the thick of it in Iraq when all this allegedly occurred. It's just, it's hard, I think, to forensically investigate in that degree. I mean, you have the guy, the medic who, you know, changes his testimony. And, I mean, God, we were sucked into this. NCIS prosecutors, you know, sent my editor and reporter, Carl Prime, himself a former Marine, emails with tracking software on him. I mean, this whole thing has just been, you know, just a massive mess, you know, from the start. And then you throw in all the politics of it and, you know, people weighing in and from both sides. And it's just, yeah, it's not a good look for the Navy or for the special operators community. And, you know, who knows what the effect will be going forward, but it's not the way you want to see, you know, a military justice process play out, I think, at all.
All right. Another email.
Sorry, I can't give you my opinion, man.
Oh, no. I know that. Mac, I started to send this email, and then I just rewrote it after you mentioned the opinion thing. Because I do understand that Jeff is a reporter. My question is kind of a factual one, kind of. Does Jeff sense that there's a broader concern for the special operations, i.e. NAV Special Warfare Group, Navy-wide among leadership, that there is concern about the number of high-profile cases that involved terrible conduct on the part of their special operators, or is this simply something that's playing out in the media?
No, I think there's concern at NAVSOC, and I think there's a concern at SOCOM. The head of SOCOM, I believe, last year kind of sent out a letter to everyone like, hey, you know, we are the elite. We need to act like the elite. We can't have these, you know, moral and ethical failures plaguing us. The NAVSOC head commissioned his own review, which, you know, the Navy promised me a copy of, and I'm still waiting on. So,
well, I said, didn't I see the preliminary report that said, yeah, we don't have a problem?
Ooh, you might have caught me on the spot there, man. I better
No.
How long ago did you see that?
It was probably after the first of the year. And I saw the story, and my jaw hit the table like, are you shitting me? So we're going to get the nothing to see here, folks? Keep moving?
Well, the CEO of NAVSOC was set to commission his own assessment and then send it up to SOCOM. That was supposed to be done in March, and that's what I've been waiting on. But, you know, either way, I think there is concern, but, you know, there's also this reality that, you know, there's not 100,000 troops in Iraq or Afghanistan anymore, and, you know, the special operators across the services are being asked to do a lot, you know, all over the world in a million different ways. I mean, you know, to say their, you know, operations tempo has been high is a cliche. I mean, it's such a bare fact, and you have these highly trained guys that kind of have to, by their very nature, operate kind of autonomously, And so I think things can spin a bit, you know, as a result. I'll give your listeners a little scoop here. I've got a SEAL-based investigation coming out very shortly that I think will add some more light, to this issue. So stay tuned for that. But yeah, I think it's the very nature of the job and the adrenaline and the autonomy all kind of can make oversight a bit of a challenge. But I think, you know, the commands are saying they're concerned about it, how much they're just like, oh God, let us do our jobs. You know, I'm not in the room, but, you know, it's a hard job, and these are some hard issues, I guess. That answers the question.
No, it does. It does. What about, talk to us about...
I never know if I'm answering, you know, because I just start...
I know. No, it's a hazard of, interviewing reporters that take their, job seriously. And let me just tell you this. The world needs more reporters. We need less correspondents because, you know, this is, let me get your, you can give a professional opinion on your profession, yes?
Oh yeah, sure, but I was gonna say too, if I ever don't answer the question, Matt, you just tell me that I'm
done. Oh, trust me.
And hold my feet to the fire, right?
Trust me. But again, I know that as a reporter though, I mean, there are parameters, and unlike some of the people that we watch on TV, right, who know no bounds, they are this kind of, so let me get your opinion of your profession. The word correspondent is used, and that is because nobody wants to use, you can't use the word reporter because they don't report. They report, they analyze, and they render opinions. Is that good or bad for the news business?
I think it's bad when there's not a very clear line between, objective reporting and opinion. Nearly every, you know, newspaper in America has both a newsroom, a news gathering side, people like me, and then they have the, you know, opinion side where there's an op-ed page at the end of the main section, and there, you know, people can write opinion pieces. Excuse me. You know, and I think a lot of regular readers maybe don't realize that there are two, you know, definitive sides separated by a big wall. And, you know, I just think there's, you know, there's too many reporters offering their opinions on social media and in other ways. And, you know, you're not, if you're going to be a reporter, especially a print reporter, you aren't the story, you aren't the brand. You're there to just put facts out there and let people make up their decision, what they think about those facts. And so I think at times there is a bit too much opinionating going on. And, you know, but I also know that this is something that a lot of reporters like myself think about a lot and really work to, you know, not let their personal opinions kind of seep into their professional work.
All right. A final question. And again, it's about your profession. I think that's detrimental to the democracy. When quote unquote your brand, skews into, opinion. And then, you know, we see you, whether it's at the White House press briefing or whatnot, it's not like you're asking questions seeking information, right? It's you're standing up in front of the country and bloviating about your opinion about whatever. And then at some point, to me, the truth is not the goal. It's, you know, my brand, it's my perspective. And I think the democracy needs the truth, and it needs reporters, and those lines should be fairly clear, but I think money is shoving everything the other way. And do you agree or disagree with that trend? And do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing for the democracy?
I really believe in reporters keeping their heads down and doing their jobs. You know, this is not supposed to be a job that, I mean, it should get you glory and acclaim if you produce some blockbuster reporting. But again, there's just too much, you know, in my opinion, reporter as brand. But, you know, it's like any job. I mean, right. I'm sure you knew some grandstanders, you know, when you were in the service. Like, you're just like, oh, God, this guy, you know, thinks he's the, you know, the best shit to come along ever or whatever. And
right.
Every
right.
industry has that. But, right. you know, it's just, and, you know, I mean, it's, I think about it a lot and I read a lot about it and, you know, but at the end of the day, like anything, all I can do is, you know, put my head down, file another FOIA and keep, you know, just putting the facts out there, you know?
Right. What, all right, what are you writing about today?
Oh, today I just, you know, every day is kind of a mix of immediate, you know, our newsroom is so small and, you know, I got this whole Navy to cover. So it's a mix of kind of immediate daily stuff, you know, some kind of crime, sailor related little short pieces. And then, you know, a couple projects that I try to dedicate an hour to every day. I mean, you know, if you're not at a big newsroom where you're just an investigative reporter, you could have months to work on stuff. It's really a mix of, okay, what's the fire I got to put out right now? And then let me make a little time for this thing that'll run in a few months. So it's basically just another day. And, you know, I can't really talk about what's coming before, you know, it hits the thing other than the SEAL story I mentioned. But, yeah, you know, just digging in as usual. So,
all right.
I appreciate everybody who reads.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's interesting having reporters on, and, gone are the days of, the Carl Burns and Bob Woodward, you know, gigantor newsroom, as newsrooms all over the world really get pressed by the competition of the internet and 24-hour news cycle. How many articles do you write a day? I think it's interesting for listeners to hear what people who write, how much they produce in a given day.
Yeah, again, we're a very small shop,
right.
But, I'm kind of the reporter who's never short on stories, both short ones and longer ones. I got plenty of stuff to work on, but, you know, usually a story a day, I think, is pretty average, but often it'll be just a very short piece, like, you know, this sailor was killed in a cycle accident this weekend outside San Diego or something like that, or, you know, this chief is going to court martial for this, you know, outrageous allegation, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, that's it, and then, you know, once that's kind of off my plate, I pivot and do the longer-term stuff. I mean, it's just, again, it's just kind of the nature of the beast and the nature of, you know, newsrooms across America having to do more with less.
Yeah, no, we would call it...
You know, if anybody, you know, feels this concern about the future of journalism in America, subscribe to your local paper. You know, it's, I know we do everything, all news on our phone now, but, you know, I still subscribe to the hard paper where I live, and, you know, it's nice to sit down with it, and, you know, you tend to find stories you didn't go search out, and it can kind of broaden you up. But, you know, that's the key to staying in this industry, is everybody subscribing to whatever local news source they have. And I'll step off my soapbox there.
No, I'll tell you what, just I'll let you go on this, but it was interesting. There was a Senator House hearing, and Google was there, and you had editors from newspapers around the country talking about content and what happens when it's aggregated and how revenue doesn't come back to them, and how they're dying, and that they will be extinct if something doesn't change in all this. So your words are profound in their timeliness. So
let me go on a rant. Google,
sure,
and Facebook have sucked up all of our goddamn revenue, and it's bullshit, and I'll just say that, and I'll end it on that.
They have it. Spoken like a true reporter. But if you don't get to that, for instance, I mean, and so people would hear that and like, what, you know, how did you used to sell your old bike? You put an ad in the paper, right?
Yep.
All that revenue was what made your newspaper go, right? I mean, so you had, you know, how'd you find a job? Well, they put ads in the paper. That entire revenue stream is gone.
Yeah, and then ad revenue too, you know, I mean,
right.
People used to pay to advertise in the hard newspaper, and now it goes online, but like, online newspapers can't make the same money from online ads, so, you know, it's a tough thing, but it's an important job, and it's really fun, I love doing it, so, you know.
Well, no, I mean, again,
we'll hold up.
The lifeblood of democracy, right, is reporters who go seek the truth, not opinion people who are, you know, who are looking to substantiate their brand and write the next sensational story. It's reporters who on a daily basis around the nation uncover the truth so that people can make informed decisions, both elected people and people that go to the ballot box. And, you know, the democracy needs that. It's important. So I'm with you on hating Google, man. I'm all about it.
All right. Thanks, man. I appreciate you having me on.
No, always, always fun to have you on, Jeff. All the best, and we're huge fans, so keep up the good work.
Yeah, tell your listeners, if they ever have any questions about the biz or anything I write, they can always drop me an email or hit me up on Twitter. I'm glad to explain how the sausage is made whenever I can.
All right. Tell everybody where they find your work.
Yeah, sure. Let's see. You can go to NavyTimes.com, MilitaryTimes.com. My email is Jeff Z, G-E-O-F-F-Z as in Zulu, at MilitaryTimes.com. I'm on Twitter at JournoJeffZ. Last name is a Polish monstrosity, but if you search me out, you should be able to find it. So.
Yeah, the one with all the consonants, okay? So just look for that
one. Oh, God. We visited my late grandpa when I was a kid in the Polish cemetery, and there was, like, some 12-letter name that had, like, one vowel in it. You know, it was just amazing stuff.
We just moved some drones, right? The airport just moved some drones from somewhere in Poland, somewhere in Romania, so closer to the Black Sea. And I tried to make an attempt at pronouncing the Polish base's name. It didn't last. It didn't go.
Not so much, yeah.
Not so much. Anyway, yeah. All right, bud. All the best of luck. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, man. Talk soon.
You bet. That is Jeff Zazulowicz, the one and only. how about that? How do you really feel about Facebook? I mean, about how do you really feel about Google? That was hilarious. I love that. No, let me just, it's interesting. It would be interesting to look at the slate of who's been run out of the Navy by the various scandals that they've had. And as Jeff said, the bench is thin. There have been so many people that were sucked up into many of these controversies. What is the implication for the service? Is the implication that it's not the best and brightest running it, but it's the best and brightest out of those that are still there? So, anyway, interesting guy. Yeah, that's the most definite opinion that he's ever shared on the program about Google. Oh, my God, that was hilarious. All right, more of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it. Don't touch that dial. The All Warrior Radio Network.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
To be fully fit, you have to be physically fit. You also have to be mentally fit.
I wish that more warriors would realize how important it is that you get the psychological support that you need so that you can focus on the rest of your life.
I think it takes strength in order to admit that you have an issue, but it also takes intuitiveness of a friend, a leader, a supervisor to pick up on the signal that the soldier is having issues and needs to seek professional help in dealing with it.
It's also important for the lowest possible levels of leadership to be very supportive in helping their members get the help that they need.
When I went to get help, I had more help than I could ask for from my entire command.
It's sometimes challenging to come to a senior staff member or senior officer in the unit with a problem. There's not a commanding officer out there or a leadership staff out there that doesn't want to help. So don't hesitate. Come ask.
Learn more by visiting www.realwarriors.net or calling 1-866-966-1020.
Hundreds of thousands of veterans have taken off their uniforms and put them away, carefully packed and safely stowed. But for some veterans, the uniform isn't so easily removed. The emotions experienced while serving continue to weigh on them. Life after service is different. Many veterans find transitioning difficult, and daily life is no longer as enjoyable as it once was. Some feel overwhelmed and lost. But that uncertainty doesn't take away from their strength and courage, nor does it take away from the sense of duty veterans carry with them. The transition from service is different for everyone. If you are a veteran going through a difficult time, or know one who is, the power of one person, one connection, one act of compassion can make a difference. For free 24/7 confidential support, call the Veterans Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1, or visit veteranscrisisline.net.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
I remember walking around the court square sidewalks, looking in the windows for things I couldn't want. There's Johnson's Hardware and Morgan's Jewelry and the old Lee King's Apothecary. They were the little man, the little man. I go back now, the stores are empty, except an old Coke sign dated 1950. Boarded up like they never existed, renovated and called historic business. There goes
Alan Jackson.
There goes the little man.
Now the court square's just a set of streets.
Hey Mac, it's Bernstein, not Carl Byrne. Is that what I said? I thought I said Bernstein. Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward. Oops. Hey, that was like on the fly, okay? The big newsroom, right? Thing of the past, man. If you look at most of, if you look at any website, I mean, and it's been interesting having Alex Hollings on, because, I mean, he's like a news factory, that guy, right? And Zulowich, pretty big name in military reporting, so people know that guy. And so maybe he doesn't have to write as much, but when he said a piece a day, and then he gets that out and works on other stuff. So the newsroom, very very different, very very different. And his advice pretty good. If you want your local newspaper to stay in business, you should subscribe to it, either in digital format or in home delivery format. You know, remember the day you get up and you walk out and you get the newspaper and when it was raining, hope they put it in plastic or hope they got it to the porch or called the newspaper, tell the kid to bring another one because yours is soaked or didn't show up or all that. Yeah, that's pretty much a thing of the past. That's pretty much a thing of the past. The yeah, so if I misspoke. I got a really interesting email that I took issue with. So we were talking about Gettysburg last week. And I had an artilleryman send me hold on, I gotta find it. It was stop blaming the Confederate artillery for the defeat at Gettysburg. All right, here's the email. I preface my remarks by admitting that I am not an expert on Civil War artillery, even though he's a big-time Artie guy. In your discussion with Tim on July 3rd, you were rightfully critical of Confederate artillery performance at Gettysburg. The Confederate artillery was hampered by poor equipment and ammunition, tactical employment, command and control. Conversely, the Union artillery excelled in all these same areas, and that advantage was demonstrated in spades on July 3rd, 1863. Okay, now, having said all that, here's my point, and he goes on. Okay, so, and I'll get to that in a minute. But, so in terms of the Confederate poor equipment and ammunition, okay, it's not like those problems first surfaced in, at Gettysburg. Every time they went into action, they dealt with those issues. So the fact that it's an issue at Gettysburg, you know, it's not the first time they're doing it. And so I don't accept that as a reason for the poor, for not seeing where the strike of their rounds landed. Okay, I don't accept that. I reject that. And here's why. Okay, so the distance between Cemetery Ridge. In fact, let me pull up Google Earth. I love maps, by the way. Yeah, we're gonna do a deep dive into the Confederate artillery at Gettysburg. Okay, so let me pull up the battlefield here. Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Go. My earth is spinning right now. Oh my God, look at all the pushpins I have in here. I love maps, man. I love maps. All right, so there's the visitor center. All right. Wow. I don't know that I've been to that visitor center. All right, here's Cemetery Ridge. All right, here's Seminary Ridge. There's the peach orchard, right? There's Little Round Top. Now, the distance, I mean, is nothing from between where Lee set up his artillery and where the rounds had the impact, okay? So I believe, since they weren't in the tree line and they weren't north near, right, they were about here. Okay. So I'll measure. So the distance that they fired at was, do you want it in yards, feet, meters? How about meters? All right. So the distance is 1500 meters. It's nothing. But we should know the time. And if when we shoot, we don't hear, right? Or are there too many guns for us to hear? But the fact that our artillery is not impacting, right, the ground near where we're, I mean, we just fired over the ridgeline. So to me, I reject. So the point that I'm going to make, and now I'm having a reservation about it, is that if I'm shooting a cannon, right? I should know time of flight. So it goes boom, and we should hear a in the not too distant future, right? And it might be a second or two. It might be 3 seconds, time of flight. I should probably figure that out. No, I don't want to. I don't want it to go that deep dive. But we should hear something. And if we're not hearing something, that means either it was a dud or we're not hitting our target. And it went over the ridgeline and went for a few miles. So but these problems didn't just crop up at Gettysburg. So they should have known. They should have known. Did they not have observers in the seminary, cupola? Could you not go up there? Was that not safe? Was there no other place to observe those fires from? So you couldn't observe them. The email goes on. Napoleon said, God fights on the side with the best artillery. There is no doubt the Union had the best artillery on the field at Gettysburg. The most talented artillery officer in America, Brigadier General Henry Hunt, served as the Army of Potomac's Chief of Artillery at Gettysburg. Hunt literally wrote the book on artillery tactics and employment prior to the war. His organizational development of the Corps Artillery Brigades and Army Artillery Reserve were instrumental in crushing the Confederate attack on July 3rd. Hunt's page on Wikipedia describes some of his actions on July 3rd and the impact they had on his battle. All right, I got a few minutes, so let me make you smart. Hunt's most famous service in the war was at the Battle of Gettysburg in July of 1863. His new commander, Major General George Gordon Meade, had considerably more respect for Hunt than Hooker did, and not only gave him great latitude in directing the artillery, but also used him on occasion as his personal representative. For example, on July 2nd, Meade sent Hunt to visit the 3rd Corps, commanded by Dan Sickle, in an attempt to get his defensive lines to conform to orders. Sickle's insubordinate movement from Cemetery Ridge, where he had been ordered to defend, to the Peach Orchard, caused considerable difficulty for the entire Union defense. Yeah, and actually almost screws the whole thing up. Hunt was unable to influence the irascible political general, Sickles, but his masterful analysis of terrain and placement of batteries on the ridge were important factors in the Union eventual success of the second day. So, the way Hunt ultimately supported Sickles and Sickles' stupidity saves that position, according to this. His handling of the artillery was conspicuous in the repulse of Pickett's charge. During a morning inspection, Hunt observed that activity in the Confederate lines and rightly concluded an assault was being readied. Later, with the Union line on Cemetery Ridge under massive bombardment from Longstreet's Artillery Corps, Edward Porter Alexander, Hunt was able to resist command pressure from the fiery 2 Corps commander, General Winfield Scott Hancock, who had demanded the Union fire to lift the spirits of the infantrymen pinned down under Alexander's bombardment. Hunt ordered that counter-battery fire cease to conserve ammunition, reserving sufficient amounts of anti-personnel fire in the attack he knew was coming. For the attack he knew was coming, it should read. So he limited their counter-battery fire. So counter-battery fire, right? They shoot, their artillery batteries shoot at something, we shoot at their artillery batteries. Counter-battery fire. All right. Hunt also directed his cannons to cease fire slowly to create the illusion that they were being destroyed one by one, which fooled the Confederates into thinking his batteries were destroyed and triggered their disastrous charge. His concealed placement of Freeman McGilvery's batteries north of Little Round Top caused massive casualties in the infantry assault. So this is like the equivalent of a machine gun on your flank, which that's not a good thing, right? Because when a machine gun shoots, it shoots a lot of bullets. And if it's able to hit your flank, that means when you're online kind of advancing, that means it's not going to get one person, it's going to get a bunch of people. Hunt was rewarded for his service with the Brevet colonel in the regular army. So these guys advanced in during the war, right? And they were made, like Custer became, you know, I want to say a brigadier general during the war. He then, at the end of the war, reverts to his peacetime rank, which I want to say was major or lieutenant colonel. Brevet, right? A former type of military commission conferred especially for outstanding service by which an officer was promoted to a higher rank without the corresponding pay. So he was a brevet colonel, which means he's frocked. He's a frocked whatever the hell he was before that, lieutenant colonel. Anyway, this goes on. Hunt reported in detail on the artillery's role at Gettysburg. He always maintained that the Confederate attack would never have happened had he been allowed to do what he'd intended, conserve his long-range ammunition during the initial southern bombardment, then hit them with everything he had when they lined up for the advance. Whoa. He said they would have never got off, they would have never got out of their position. Hunt's creation and employment of the Army Artillery Reserve allowed him to replace batteries damaged by the Confederate preparation fires and fresh units and provided much-needed ammunition to ensure the Union had enough on-hand ammunition to repel Pickett's charge. The attached monograph provides additional details if your listeners are interested. Hunt needs to be mentioned in the same breath as Meade, Buford, Vincent, Hancock, et al. When discussing the key Union. You know what? That is well taken. Now, and what he sent me was artillery employment in the Battle of Gettysburg. This thesis is presented to the faculty of the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College in partial fulfillment of the requirement for the degree of Master of Military Art and Sciences by Mark R. Gilmore, Major United States Army, who graduated from the University of Oregon. No, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Oregon State University in 1977. This paper is dated Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, 1989. So this is probably Major Mark Gilmore's thesis. Pretty in depth. So, but again, my point is this, okay? So, the Confederate, if they had just hit their target, if they had, given all that's happened, they still got to Cemetery Ridge. If they would have just hit their target, given the amount of artillery, right? Given the amount of artillery, how about this? Number of guns. Hold on. I can't type and talk at the same time. Number of guns at least fired on day 3 at Gettysburg. A massive assault. This says over 150. The number I've seen is over 200. But even then, 150 artillery pieces. Okay. Facts. This is supposed to be day 3, and I gotta wade through all this nonsense. Uh-oh, there's Pickett's charge. Pickett, his moment of glory. Not so much. Boy was never the same after that. On day 3. I'm looking for the number of guns. Okay. At 1 o'clock, when the Confederate artillery began the first phase of the battle plan, over 150 guns opened fire on the Union center. The Federals returned fire, and the most massive artillery bombardment during the Civil War had begun. The sound was so loud that the gunners' ears bled. The barrage was so loud it could be heard as far away as Philadelphia and Baltimore. For over an hour, the artillery duel continued. At a little past 2 p.m., the Union began to slowly stop firing. This was a trick to deceive the Confederates into believing they had knocked out the Union guns. The trick worked at 3 p.m., 1500, that is, military time for all you military people. Right? The rebels stopped firing. Now they're rebels. They were dangerously low on ammunition and needed to conserve it as much as possible. Well, the Union was in the same position. So, and again, so the question isn't any of that. Is that they missed. They missed. If they had only hit, given, again, everything else said is, I'll give you is valid. Okay? But they got up there and they mixed it up. If they had just hit their intended targets, my own personal belief is if the Confederate artillery would have simply hit what they were aiming at, that Pickett would not have been repulsed. He would have taken heavy casualties on the walk across that open pasture, because that's over a click in the open. But it was smoky that day, right? So to me, they would not have been, they would have blown a hole in the Union center. Because those guys are all sitting there on the forward slope, praying to God they don't get their ass blown away. But anyway, I thought I'd share that email with you. Here's one about Gettysburg. Ohio man. While I am not as studied as you at Gettysburg, after reading High Tide, it's quite apparent to me that multiple things went wrong for Lee throughout the 3 days. Any one of which being reversed with a better decision or outcome probably leads to a Southern victory. That's in fact true. And some of it is Union leadership and some of it is Confederate mistakes, which hadn't happened at that point. You know, the Army of Northern Virginia, which Robert E. Lee commanded, they had made mistakes in the past, but the Union didn't have the guys in a position to make them pay because they were making their own stupid mistake. All right. And so Ohio man is right. Day one, I think goes the way of the Union. They choose, right? They choose better ground and they're in the defensive, which, right, in many cases, is the more decisive form of battle. The more advantageous form of battle. You're in the defensive. They're coming at you across open fields and whatnot. And so, in the Civil War. So, on day two, that's in fact what happens. And then, when it comes apart, and we just talked about it, Sickles moves out to the peach orchard. So the Confederates, while the left flank of the Union position is on Cemetery Ridge, really would have to go a ways to get at the left flank. Sickles presents it to him by moving, you know, towards the Confederates and out towards the Emmitsburg Pike. And by doing so, he leaves the Union left flank hanging in the air. And Longstreet's headed that way. And then there's a race further to the south, as you've heard the story of Strong Vincent and how that gap gets plugged. Hunt's a part of it, how he supports it with artillery. And then the south, Longstreet's forces that had to do this counter march and all the rest of this stuff, they eventually get there and they see the peach orchard, which they believed was supposed to be the flank, and they get hammered by artillery when they stick their faces out of the tree line across in the peach orchard. And they're like, yeah, that's not a flank that we know. And they start extending their flank to the south, which is to their own right. And so that's how they have the engagement on Little Round Top. They extend to the right. Vincent's headed to the right, and they have a meeting engagement on the top of Little Round Top, and the union prevails. And that's day two. Day three, had they, again, had the artillery guys, and again, everything that that email says is true. I'll grant you that. And Hunt probably was the better artilleryman that day. But the Confederate gunners missed. They missed. They didn't hit what they were aiming at. Now, and again, it's not the first time they fired in heavy smoke. How did they not see it? Was there no mechanism for which to spot their own rounds? Now that's what I'm curious about. Artillery spotting in the Civil War. I got to find that. So, anyway, the all right, if you're just tuning into the program right now, like, we're talking about Civil War artillery again? Yes, we are. It's important. No, because when you study battles, right, you see the timeless qualities that decide events. Which is why you study history. Justice Zulowicz joined the program today and talked about his views on what's going on with the Navy. And, you know, it's kind of an interesting, you know, thought, and that is, what has been the cumulative effect of all the different admirals that have had to resign based on what's gone on in the Seventh Fleet, based on the Fat Leonard scandal and all the rest of it? And how thin are their senior ranks? And are they paying a price for that? So kind of an interesting little comment he made. But you'll hear him. We'll check the news. We'll talk about my the wind just blew. We'll talk about I'm not a big fan of the women's national team because I'm not a big fan of Megan. What's her last name? Starts with an R. Rapinoe. I don't know how to pronounce her last name, but she was like right there with Colin Kaepernick. Clown stuff. So did not follow them. Sorry. Got an email about, what about equal pay? They should get proportionally equal pay. Here's my artillery guy bombing in. I can't get away from the arty guys. They get sensitive, man. Arty guys have feelings too. Hunt had a reserve of 118 guns organized into 21 batteries that he could use to plug holes and weigh the defense. The Union had twice as much ammunition. That's a no shit difference right there, Matt. 118 guns. He had 21 batteries. Okay, so for those of you that don't understand, battery equals company. Right, so that's seven battalions of our, if the batteries are three battery battalions, seven battalions of artillery he has in reserve, right? And you could fairly make the case that when towards the end of day two, you know, if you read the exploits of Freeman McGilvery, pretty amazing. In the peach orchard. I believe he retires from the peach orchard. Yeah, this is an artillery term. He retired by prologue. Okay, now, Google that one if you want to be impressed with how smart I am. Okay, so retired by Prologue, L-O-G-U-E, I think. Civil War. Hold on, the show's not going to end till I find this. Freeman McGilvery. Here he is. A United States Army artillery officer during the American Civil War, gained fame at the Battle of Gettysburg for taking the initiative to piece together a line of guns that greatly contributed to the Union victory. Born in Prospect, Maine, known for his love of the sea, he was a sailor and a shipmaster. Of course he was. So he was such a good artillery officer. He soon returned home and raised the 6th Maine Battery, which saw action at the Battle of Cedar Mountain, Sulphur Springs, the Battle of Antietam. His battery supported the 7th Corps on February 5th, 1863, promoted to major, given command of the 1st Volunteer Brigade in the Artillery Reserve in the Union Army of the Potomac, which he commanded during the Battle of Chancellorsville. During the Battle of Gettysburg, he had been promoted to the rank of lieutenant colonel. On July 2nd, the second day of the battle, McGilvery discovered a wide and undefended gap in the Union line along the southern end of Cemetery Ridge, north of Little Round Top. He patched together a line of artillery from various commands to fill the gap, initially without infantry support. Right? And you know what the Artie guys are saying, these idiot grunts, man. And this is where Sickles has moved out to the peach orchard. And McGilvery sees this hole, and he's like, what the fuck? McGilvery's plum run line of field pieces was instrumental in halting the final Confederate advance towards the Union center. On July 3rd, the lengthy artillery line assisted in the repulse of Pickett's charge. So it might not be Freeman McGilvery that I'm looking for, right? It might be the Peach Orchard Artillery. Peach Orchard. I think this guy dies, though. Yeah, so Freeman McGilvery died in 1864. Artillery, Peach Orchard, Civil War. Peach Orchard, geography, history, military engagement. All right. Blah, blah, blah. Lieutenant James B. Hazelton. Right? The Peach Orchard combat began with Union artillery in the orchard counterfiring on Alexander's batteries, which reduced Ames' supply of Union cannon ammunition. When Hood's assault advanced eastward over the Emmitsburg Road. Okay, so now picture this in your head. All right, you have the Peach Orchard. Okay, and we're standing in the Peach Orchard, which the Emmitsburg Pike runs in front of us, goes left and right, and then there's another street, I can't remember the name of it, that runs left. There's a peach orchard, and there's the Wirtz Farm across the pike. Okay, so the Confederates think they're going to get on our flank. Now, we're part of the left flank of Sickles that he creates, right? So Sickles moves out, and he gives them the left flank. And so you have these artillery batteries in the Peach Orchard. Now, Longstreet's guy, McClaws, two guys, McClaws and Hood, they stick their nose out of the far tree line across from us. And they got the shit boomed out of them. All right, when Hood's advance, right, starts eastward, so they're coming towards us, Ames had all of his spherical case ammunition. So this was ball bearings, right, in a metal case, and you shoved it down the cannon, the barrel, and you fired this thing, and it became like a machine gun, right? Right, beehive rounds in Vietnam, the equivalent. Lieutenant James B. Hazelton to fire at the infantry while Ames' center and right sections continued their counter-battery fire with solid shot. Yeah, the injuries in the Civil War, man. You got hit with solid shot? Like, are you kidding me? That was a bad deal. With the Confederate left flank to the south exposed. Okay, so the bad guys are coming towards, kind of to our left. And their flank is exposed. Right? The Peach Orchard was able to hammer them. So that fight's going on. And now the artillery batteries are starting to run out of ammunition. But who was the guy who retires across from the Peach Orchard through that, and it's called firing by prologue, if I'm not mistaken? I have to go get my battle and leader. No, I have to go get my Gettysburg guide, and I'll get that for you. Yeah, now it's important to me. So, anyway, but yeah, artillery at Gettysburg, no small part of the story. But again, here's what I maintain. Given all that stuff that takes place, enough of Pickett's guys got, and Pettigrew got there. Given all of that, if the Confederate artillery would have done what it was supposed to do, would have hit its target, they would have stayed up there. There would have been a hole blasted in the forward slope of that defense, that they would have stayed there, and they would have fought there for a while. So that's what I contend. That's the point I'm sticking with. And I don't buy that they had, you know, different supply and different this, different that. Yeah, they knew that, and they dealt with that in every major engagement that they dealt with. The Union didn't have the same worries because of the greater industrial power of the North. So, anyway, there you have it. Deep dive into the artillery at Gettysburg. I enjoy the conversation, by the way. I know that makes me a dork, but hey, on this planet, you are what you are. All right, now if you're just tuning in, you're going to hear Jeff Zulowitz after we talk about the news. Yeah. Lance corporals at Camp Pendleton attempting to smuggle aliens into the United States. What the hell, man? And getting caught. Now going to go to jail for a couple years. Was it worth it, boys? For $1,000 that they never got paid and never got a chance to spend. So there's a lesson in all that, boys and girls. Do you want to know what it is? I hope you do. Because if you don't want to know what it is, then that means you're stupid. Don't do stupid shit, okay? Hey, man. It's easy. Probably not. I'm not sure if you've ever gone through the border, but there's a fair number of law enforcement personnel there. The next question is, you know, again, talking to Jeff Zulowitz. The Navy, whether we talk about any kind of conflict with Iran, any kind of conflict with, you know, China, the Navy's the lead in all of that. And it's one bad story after the next. Now, let me tell you and it's not going to change anytime soon. In September, okay, which is 3 and 4, 7 weeks away, you're going to see the trial of a Navy lieutenant as a result of the Gallagher case, who's accused of obstruction of justice. That may not be the specific charge, but that's what he's generally accused of. And not doing his job. as subordinates came to him on three different occasions to report war crimes, and he discouraged them. So that's going to come. You're also going to have the trial of a petty officer by the name of Dedal, who is the who's the one who did the strangling of Staff Sergeant Melgar in Mali. That's going to come to trial. So that, I believe, coming in the fall as well. So anyway, you know, we need the Navy. We need the Navy to be good. But, you know, the Navy's gone down a road of, I would say, becoming so civilianized and so soft that it's going to take them, you know, like the Marine Corps had to dig out of their mismanagement of aviation assets, and that has taken years, and they're still dealing with it. The Navy has mismanaged a lot of different aspects of the Navy, and they've got to turn it around. And the questions that Zazulowicz raises is that, do they have the horsepower, right, at the general officer level to do that after they've been decimated by the incidents that we've seen, the Fat Leonard scandal, and all the rest of it? Pretty interesting little question. So, having said all that, on a Tuesday, live the high life, man. We have friends who didn't come back. Okay? If you don't know anything about post-traumatic winning, find out about it. Go out there and change people's lives. I did a little bit of it yesterday, and there's no better feeling on the planet than sitting down with somebody and helping them. None. And it validates the things that have happened to you in the past, and it makes your spirit stronger so that you can live with the pain that you live with, because it ain't going away. So I would recommend that you check that out. But that's why I play this song, The High Life. I have a question about the whole citizenship question thing on the census. Like, how do you not ask that? Especially if, right, the census, right, contributes to the way we district the nation relative to congressional districts. I mean, isn't it important to know that the numbers that we're counting should actually be counted? Isn't that important? So, because if it's not, then what you do is you empower parts of the country that has larger illegal immigrant populations. You know, those districts become larger. Those states have greater representation, and which ultimately reinforces their policies to allow illegals into the country. So am I off base there? So if one of the uses of the census, if one of the uses is to district the nation, then to me, I think it's fundamental to find out if the person's a citizen or not, because we don't district the nation based on illegal numbers. We just don't do it like that. So I don't know if I'm missing something, because that seems to be, you know, pretty standard stuff. Right? It seems to me to be pretty standard stuff. But maybe the census is too complicated for me to understand. But and if you look at the list of every census has asked a question about citizenship on it. Right? Except for what, 2010? I think when you look at it, you look at all these different censuses we've taken, and they've all asked it. Now, right? One would believe that putting that question on makes you a jackbooted national socialist. That's what I meant to say. And so the accusation to me that, oh, the only reason the Trump administration wanted to put it on was to affect districting. Well, wait a minute. the only reason the other side wants to keep it off is to affect redistricting. Yes? So, anyway, the murky, ugly, you know, ground of American politics these days. Is it about the truth? We both know better, right? It's not. So, with that cheery thought, I just don't, I don't get it, because when you, if the census is linked to districting, then that number's got to be a true number of legal Americans here. Not anybody that's here, legal Americans that are here. Because that adds up to political power. And you can't do political power based on a false number. At least I don't think you can. Maybe you could. So on a Tuesday, All Marine Radio is over and out. Wait, I didn't do it right. Hold on. On a Tuesday, All Marine Radio over and out.